In the mid-1800s, there was a man named Henry Beecher. He was an American Congregationalist pastor. He was a social reformer. He did a lot of great things in the United States. And if you read quotation books, I have a whole bunch of them, you'll run into, it will say H.W. Beecher, and that's him. That's Henry. Henry was really great at coming up with really pithy statements that, wow, that was really good. This is one of his statements that he made about adversity, which the first time I encountered it, I was reading a Chuck Swindoll book on dealing with suffering and adversity. And he got this from Henry. Here's what he said. Quote, "We are always, as Christians, in the forge or on the anvil, and by trials, God is shaping us for higher things." Okay, I'll read that again in case you were checked out. "We are always in the forge or on the anvil, and by trials, God is shaping us for higher things." The longer I've walked with God, I totally understand what that means. God does his greatest works in your life through suffering, through adversity, because if life was just totally easy all the way to glory, you would be shallow as a puddle. And so what he does is he brings adversity to your life, sends fire to your life, the furnace, affliction, and works on you. The other day, I was in my garage where I have my workbench and everything. I have a vise on there, and I was cutting on something with a chisel, and so I put the piece of wood in the vise, and I cranked it down. And I have pretty strong forearms, so I didn't think it was going anywhere. And as I started, working on it, it started moving on me. So what's a man to do? Tighten it even further. So as I was tightening it, I'm thinking, this is a spiritual situation. Because God's done that to me before. Put you in his little vise, cranks on it, and you're thinking, that's good. And then you wiggle a little bit in unbelief, and God said, I need to crank it down some more. And he does. And such are the ways of God. So I think H.W. Beecher is right about we're always on the forge or on the anvil, and God's using trials to educate us. We don't usually like it. No one goes, that's totally awesome, God. I love that whole vice thing. No. But it's those things, as you look back at your faith, that deepen you. When you look at your situation, I don't know what your situation is. People have a variety of furnace experiences that they're going through. Sometimes it's personal loss. It could be the loss of a job. I don't know what your affliction is. But right now, you know what it is. And the question that you're probably asking is what a man said to me this week that was going through, in our church, going through a physical situation. When I contacted him, he said, I'm wondering what God is trying to tell me in this. That is a wise statement. Because a fool would say, God, how dare you do this to me? But a wise person says, no, even in the suffering, God is sovereign. So I wonder what he's teaching me. If you would like to learn how to deal with adversity, you can go no farther than chapter 1 of 1 Samuel and learn how to deal with adversity, pain, loss, etc., from the life of a young woman named Hannah and her husband Elkanah. You'll see that their story, in many respects, can be your story, and you can learn from them how to navigate the furnace experience. As we look at this narrative literature, we'll move through it in kind of how the passage breaks down in movements of thought. So in the first seven verses, we would have what I would call the premise that trials have a tough tension, and they do, because there's always a tension within a trial, emotional tension, psychological, it could be financial, spiritual. There's always this tension that builds. Have you not ever seen anybody? It might have been you. You lose your job. You got a great resume. You got great experience. You go send out 100 resumes, and you hear from zero people. And you call me and you're like, what in the world? I didn't even get, not even an email thank you from anybody, and no follow-ups, and what in the world? And that tension that builds, you send out another 100, you still get zero. That's that tension that we're gonna talk about, because we live in it as people who walk with God, but we wanna make sense out of it. So Hannah's tension was tension that was related directly to her marriage. It starts in verse 1 where we find out about her marriage. Says there was a certain man that they're going to name in a minute. He was from a really well-known place, Ramathaim Zophim. Serious? Why would they name a town like that? Ramathaim Zophim. It was in the hill country of Ephraim. And his name was Elkanah. Who would name their child that? Well, they did. And I'll tell you what his name means in a minute. And they're going to give us this exciting genealogical list. Elkanah, he's the son of who? Well, some guy named Jehoram, who was the son of Elihu, was the son of Tohu, who was the son of Zuf. And these people were Ephraimites. Okay, let's move on. You might not think that's an important thing to read. Genealogical lists are highly exciting. I don't know how you feel about Chronicles. Most people are reading through the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, blah, blah, blah. And then you hit Chronicles. Put the brakes on. Chapters of genealogical lists. And you're like, what in the world was the Holy Spirit doing here? So when you see genealogical lists, you must stop and ask yourself, why is that there? Because it's there for a reason, as I'm going to show you. So let's first talk about where they were from. They were from where? Ramathim Zophim. So if you go to Jerusalem, and you can see Jerusalem on the map, and Jerusalem is highly mountainous. It's very beautiful there. Forests surrounding Jerusalem. It's absolutely gorgeous. If you go straight north and a little bit west into the country, the tribal country of Ephraim, on the main road going straight up from Jerusalem, when you get into about the middle of Ephraim, where the M is, you see the M? About there is Shiloh, where the tabernacle was. And if you hang a left there and go 15 miles on the little road down the mountain grade, that's called the Shephelah, or the low-lying hills in Hebrew. That's where this Ramathaim Sophim was. I will tell you what it means in Hebrew, and you're like, oh, that totally makes sense. If you translate it from the Hebrew, the word means twin heights. Now that, where do you live? Twin heights. How do you say it? Ramathaim Sophim. Why don't you just say twin heights? Because we speak Hebrew. And so it was a kind of a cool place to live. I've been in this area before. Samuel the prophet was buried in this area. It's a lot of very hilly, little valleys here, and it's totally gorgeous. This is where Elkanah is from. Would you say this is a very famous town? Not really. I would call it Nowheresville. It's a little village, Nowheresville, with the man. It's like, who's this guy, Elkanah? A Nowheresville town, Nowheresville person, etc. But these are the kind of people God uses. Not the super rich and famous all the time, although he can. But God specializes in taking people like this and doing great things with them. And what's up with his lineage? Because I told you his lineage is highly important. Well, if you go to 1 Chronicles 6, verses 22 to 28, you will find a fuller description of his genealogical list. And if you were to read that, and I'll summarize it for you so you don't have to right now. But if you go over there and read that genealogical list, you will find out that Elkanah was from the family line of Kohath. You're going, oh yeah, now I totally get it. You're thinking, serious? Now, what does that mean? Well, Kohath was a son of Levi. Now, you should be able to connect some Bible study method dots here at this point. Levi, he's a priest, which means, process of deduction, Kohath is a priest, and anyone that came from Kohath is a priest. So guess what Elkanah is? He's a priest. Oh, he's a priest. Our version of a pastor. Then you must ask another question. Of the sons of Levi, what were their duties as sons when it came to the tabernacle? Because they had to move the tabernacle around when they were in the wilderness wandering. So they had to move the outer fence and all of the different skins that they had, the badger skin and all the different skins they had to move to cover it. Well, what about the inner components? You know, as you got closer to the sacred things, who moved those? Well, the tribe that within the family line of Levi that moved the Ark of the Covenant, the menorah, the table of showbread, the altar of incense, that was the Kohathites. Oh, so this means this is an unusual priest. We're going to find out, as a priest, he didn't have it all together. Sometimes pastors don't, right? You're thinking, I really hope the pastor had his life all together. No, they can make mistakes. He did, because we read in verse 2, and we'll show you the text and you'll see what I mean, that he had problems. Why are you laughing? He had two wives. Serious? Two? You know, I've been married 44 years. I love my wife. It's not all simple. It's a series of negotiations. I lose, she wins, and I just do what she says, you know? No, just kidding. No, you had two friends talking to each other through things, facing things together. It's awesome. A healthy marriage is an awesome thing, with Jesus, of course, at the center. This guy, he just made a major mistake. Could you imagine two wives? Right? Two ladies trying to train you? Men, you realize this, right? He had two wives. Now, when you go back in into the Torah, Genesis, when God set things up, he didn't make Adam and Eve and Connie, okay? It was Adam and Eve. So God said, when I set this thing up, it just should be a man and a woman, right? Monogamy, that's the way it should be, blah, blah, blah. They came up with this other thing. And why'd they do it? Well, they rationalized. And how they rationalized was this in the Semitic mind. What they did is they said, God wants us to replenish the earth and multiply. In fact, those are the first commands in the book of Genesis are these commands to replenish the earth. So if you marry Hannah and she's not producing children, which she wasn't, you're thinking as a man, I've got to have children. I got to have future priests. I've got to give my family holdings off to somebody. I need a son. Therefore, Hannah, it's been years. She's not producing children. So I'll just do what Abraham did. I'll get another wife. And so he did. Her name is Peninnah. So you have Hannah, and then the new wife's name is Peninnah. Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. So all of a sudden, he introduces us to the fact that in their marriage, he, based on his small compromise, it becomes a huge problem because these two women don't get along. Hannah, her name means grace. And by the way, I forgot to tell you what the name Elkanah means. Elkanah means God creates something. Boy, is he, when you look at the end of this chapter, God's going to create something that's going to blow his mind and also bless the nation. We'll talk about that more later. Hannah, her name means gracious. That was his first wife. His second wife was Peninnah, whose name means pearl in Hebrew. But I would say to you, from translating that from the Hebrew, she was anything but a pearl. Because when you think of a pearl, you're thinking white, beautiful, et cetera, you know, shiny, wonderful, blah, blah, blah. Now, if I were to translate her name in another Hebrew word, I would have called her problem. Because she is a problem, this second wife. And so what I say in the first two verses, this sounds great in verse one, Elkanah, blah, 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 he's a priest. Verse two, slight compromise. He's just telling you, this small compromise is going to become a huge problem in their marriage and mess up their marriage. But I would say that he did have strengths. And one of the strengths that he had was keeping his family in worship of the living God, which I would just say as a side note is the smartest thing you can do. I mean, if the Lord Jesus is at the center of your relationship, it's like the hub on a bicycle wheel with spokes, and he's the hub, then all facets of your life then go back to that. Your finances, how you raise kids, how you discipline kids, all that goes back to Jesus as the hub, and he gives meaning and wisdom and understanding to your marriage. That's how I view 44 years of awesomeness being married to Liz, is because Christ is at the center. And so he made God at the center of his relationship. And so we see that in verse 3. It said, this man would go up from his city yearly to worship and to sacrifice the Lord of hosts in Shiloh, about 15 miles east of his town. And when he got there, he says, the two sons of Eli, the high priest, their names were Hophni and Phinehas. They were the priests of the Lord there. So he throws in Eli, the high priest, who was running the tabernacle in Shiloh, and he had two sons, Hophni and Phinehas. Why'd he throw them in? Because he's going to throw them in because they're going to become antagonists. So you can say Elkanah, Hannah, protagonists, and then the antagonists are going to be Peninnah and Eli, the high priest, and Hophni and Phinehas. Because Hophni and Phinehas, as we're going to learn, when people would come to worship the Lord in the tabernacle at Shiloh before they moved everything to Jerusalem, they would sexually take advantage of women in line for church. Talk about hideous. When the priesthood is compromised in a nation, it's well nigh to the judgment of God Almighty. And that's what you're going to see. So in the period of Judges, when everybody did which was right in their own eyes, the priests got in on the action. And said, well, if everybody has what they want, then why can't we do what we want? And we'll see. This is exactly what they did. And their father, Eli, won't do a thing about it. So just park that in your mind for right now. So we see he goes up to worship the Lord. And according to the Torah, a man had to go take his family up to Israel three times a year to worship God, Passover, Pentecost, and Tabernacles. Most couldn't make all three because it was very expensive. And so they would pick one and they would go. So we don't know which one they went to, but he's at least taking his family to worship the living God. We're introduced to the high priest, to his sons, Hophni and Phinehas, because we're going to see that in the middle of all of this mess and compromise among the priesthood, God is working a plan through a family from Nowheresville to bless the nation. And that could be your family. God's going to take you and use you to not just bless your family, but bless the culture, the city, etc. It's how God rolls. In verse 4, it says, when the day came that Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to Peninnah, his wife, and to all of her sons and her daughters. Notice it's plural, sons and daughters, plural. But to Hannah, he would give a double portion. Why? Well, he loved Hannah more than he loved Peninnah. You think that caused problems? Yeah, see, he just goes from problem to problem. And the problem is, Peninnah is having multiple little boys and little girls. Hannah has none, and he tells you why with the adversative but. But what had the Lord done? It says, he had sovereignly closed the womb of Hannah. And you know, when you read it, you're thinking to yourself, that is absolutely does not sound fair. Hannah, gracious, she's a humble woman, she's a godly woman. And why wouldn't God give her children? So all those years that went by when Peninnah keeps having children, Hannah's sitting there every time they go up the mountain to worship in Shiloh. All these little kids are in the entourage and she has none. This creates a great emotional battle between the two women. But one of the ways that I look at it is when it doesn't seem like it's fair that God gives you what you're yearning for, God does his best work, as far as I can understand in my life so far in studying scripture. He does his best work in your life when you experience suffering. That's just when he gets your attention. And sometimes it's only for a short time as the window opens and you listen to God, but he gets your attention in suffering. There's an old statement that says, no pressure, no diamonds. No pressure, no diamonds. So I did a little research to say, okay, well, how does a diamond form? A diamond forms typically at 125 miles below the Earth's surface in absolute pressurized darkness. Down that deep, the Earth's pressure is 50,000 times greater than the Earth's surface. High pressure, high heat, 2,912 degrees forms a diamond. So if you have a diamond on your finger right now and you're thinking, it's so beautiful, I bought it here and there, I just love it, etc. Think of what it went through to become a diamond. Had it not gone through pressure and heat and darkness, it would not be what it is. And that's God in your life. He does pressurize things in your life. In Hannah's life, closed her womb to deepen her, to get her to follow him no matter what. Will you follow me if I give you children? Will you follow me if I don't? He's working in her life. He's working in your life. That's how God rolls. When we had our firstborn son, my son Nathan, who's in church today, we named him because I was working on a degree in Hebrew at the time. Nathaniel means gift of God. Well, we knew he was a gift as a firstborn. We didn't know what kind of gift he would be. And indeed, he has been a gift, but his gift came through special needs. When you have a special needs child, it conditions and hones the soul. When I was about, 27, 28 years old, working through the fact that I'll never teach him Hebrew, I'll never teach him Greek, I'll never teach him German, because that's not where he's going to be. I came across a statement by A.W. Tozer, and A.W. Tozer said this, and my whole life has been built around this one statement. Unless God hurts you deeply, he cannot use you greatly. Unless God hurts you deeply, he cannot use you greatly. So in Hannah's hurt, God is saying, Hannah, I got great things for you. Just hold on and follow me anyway. And God's gonna bless her. God's gonna bless you. But it says this greatness doesn't come out without great trial. It says in verse 6, her rival, Peninnah, however, when they would go to eat and to worship, would provoke her bitterly and irritate her because the Lord had closed her womb. It now said twice God did this. It happened year after year. So Peninnah's got one baby, two babies, three babies, four babies, five babies. And every time they go up to worship, there's this huge problem as they travel. You can just hear. I mean, have you ever had somebody who just flat out irritated you? They're like, are they sitting near you? I mean, they're just a problem. You don't want to go to work because you know that Peninnah's there, you know, or Larry or whatever, whoever the person is. And that's this lady, because you can imagine as they're in their little entourage going up the hill to Shiloh to worship God at the tabernacle, you could probably figure out what Peninnah is saying to Hannah as they travel, right? Stuff like, wow, look at all my children. Isn't it wonderful? Where are yours? Your name is Gracious. Why isn't God gracious to you like he's gracious to me? What's wrong with you? See? And this is, you can see this animosity. This went on year after year, but you don't read of Hannah really doing too much until you get to the next section, verses 8 to 18. when she moves from constant tension to doing something about it. And this is what the way God rolls. He sends adversity to your soul to condition you, to whittle you down, to then get you to see what you need to do. What do you need to do? Well, you need to get to prayer. Remember that old song? Not that I'm a singer, and I'm not going to attempt to sing, but I know the song. Have a little talk with Jesus. Remember that song? I've dated myself. Have a little talk with Jesus. Tell him about your troubles. Yeah, why? Because he listens to you. And he will act based upon what you do when you pour your heart out. So she is, for the first time in her life, after years of irritation from Peninnah, she's finally going to break down and go to God. Notice the process of how she gets there. Verse 8. She's crying. She's emotional because she's constantly attacked by this woman. She doesn't feel like she can eat, enjoy the time of festivities. And so her husband tries to console her. And men, because I'm one, aren't the greatest sometimes at telling their wives what they need to hear. Guys try to be problem solvers when the wife's just wanting you to just listen to her. Notice how he responds to her weeping, crying over being battered by this evil woman. What's he say to her? Her husband said to her, "Hey, Hannah, why do you weep?" Serious? Like, you don't know why I'm crying? And why did you not eat? And why is your heart so sad? I'm thinking, are you absolutely clueless? And then he throws in, this didn't go over well. Am I, Elkanah, not better than 10 sons? Is that what she wanted to hear? No, she just wants one son. Husbands, have you ever said anything to your wife you wish that you would have never, like, you could retract this? Has this happened? Why are you so quiet? Okay, because I've done it. I can tell you when I did it. Like, how old I was when I did it. I'll just tell you one, which I cannot believe I ever said that, but I did. When Liz was pregnant with Nathan. We're in Dallas, Texas, going to seminary. It's hot, it's humid. She's 8.5 months pregnant. And I made this statement one day. "Honey, I cannot wait till you have this child so we can get our lives back to normal." Do I need to repeat that? On a lame meter, is that like pegged at 10, 1? What would you say? It's probably an 11, yeah. That's something that our family remembers now. "Dad said this." Because our lives never went back to normal, right? Have you had a child yet? Yeah, your life's not the same anymore. And so, you know, yeah, I'm sure when he said this, he thought, "Oh, I should not have ever said that." It says in verse 9, Hannah arose. She didn't even take him on. She didn't say, "Honey, you should have never said that." That's not what I'm looking for. It says in verse 9, she arose after eating and drinking and hearing this conversation from her husband in Shiloh. And now Eli, the priest, was sitting on the seat of the doorpost of the temple of the Lord. So she walks over to the temple. She goes to church, as it were. So her tension has moved her heart in her walk with God to now seeking God in a profound way. It says in verse 10, when she walked, and there's only one gate into the tabernacle, because Jesus said, "I am the way, truth, and the life, and no man comes to the Father but through me." He's the door. And so the tabernacle had one door. You had to go through that one door, and the first thing you met was the altar of sacrifice. If your sin was not covered by sacrificial blood, you're not right with God. So she goes through the door, and she runs into Eli, the priest. She's weeping bitterly, and she made a vow in her prayer to God. "O Lord of hosts, if thou wilt indeed look upon my affliction of thy maidservant and remember me and not forget thy maidservant, but will give thy maidservant a son," then she says, "I will make a vow to you. I will give him to the Lord, all the days of his life, and no razor shall ever come upon his head." You ever prayed like that? "God, I have wanted this for years, and if you give this to me, I don't want it to keep it. I will give this 100% back to you forever. I don't want to hold on to it." To her, it was a son. And when she finally got down to that point, she's pouring out her heart. This tells you a lot about us and about God, that God whittles us down to get you to a point where you, in great emotion, will let go of yourself and say, I can't think through this one anymore. I can't make this happen. I need God to help me. That's where she's at. That's where you might be. And when you go to a prayer with God like that, you must remember what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 7. That whole passage and around verse 9 where he says, you know, "Ask, seek, and knock, and it shall be, you know, open for you." After that, what he said, he's talking about prayer. In verse 9, he says this. He says, what man is there among you, arguing from the lesser to the greater, from God to us? He says, or from a man to God. What man is there among you when a son shall ask him for a loaf, will give him a stone? Jesus was so logical. If your son comes up to you after church and I'm so Pastor Marty, finally landed the plane and the service is over. I'm hungry. And you say, yeah, would you, he says, hey, could I have some bread? And you know, I've got a river rock for you here. What dad's going to do that? No dad is. Jesus said, no dad's going to do that. Or if your son asks for a fish, he's not going to give him a snake. I mean, what dad's going to do that? Hey, dad, I need a fish. No, here's a live rattlesnake. Yeah, right. Or for Danita, it's a diamondback. Just saying. Will he do that? No. He says, if you then being evil know how to give God good gifts to your children, how much more shall your Father who's in heaven give good that which is good to those who ask him? What's he telling you? If your dad on the planet will only give good things to you that will not harm you, will only benefit you, won't God do that which is greater than your father? Answer is, yeah. The problem is we don't trust God. No, I think he might be capricious in this situation. Or he might do something I don't want to. I'm not even going to ask it. No, God's like, just ask. And so she's asking, and God could have told her, no, that is not the best for you to have a son. But he said, this has been enough years, your heart is conditioned. I'll answer that prayer, and I'll give you that which is good for you now. But sometimes it may not be good for you. But either way, you should say, I will follow you, Lord, whatever you ask of me. She said, if you give me this child, I'll give him back to you, and I won't cut his hair. What is he, like a hippie? Remember, I grew up in the 60s, watched all my friends. Like, what is the deal? In Old Testament times, if you had hair like that, according to number 6, you were a Nazirite. Oh, a Nazirite. You made a Nazaritic vow that a certain amount of your life was going to be devoted to God, but not all of it, but a special time of devotion to God. She says, I'll go way beyond the mandate of a Nazaritic vow, and I'll give you my son for his entire life. Eli the priest was not the sharpest knife in the drawer. He's going to be the second man who's clueless in the passage. Number 12, verse 12. As it came about as she continued praying before the Lord that Eli was watching her mouth. And as for Hannah, she was speaking in her heart, only her lips were moving, but her voice was not heard. So Eli thought she was drunk because he had probably seen people come drunk to church before because that was the time they lived in. Remember, everybody did that which was right in their own eyes. And then Eli said to her, how long are you going to make yourself drunk? Put away your wine from you. This is interesting. The man who won't confront his own sins, sons for their sins, taking advantage of women in line of worship, he won't even confront them. He confronts a woman pouring her heart out to God to bless her with a child. He's totally clueless. Hannah answered and said to him, she's going to confront the priest. No, my Lord, I am a woman oppressed in spirit. I've drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I poured out my soul to the Lord. Do not consider your maidservant as a worthless woman. For I have spoken until now out of my great concern and provocation. Translated, you don't know what I've been through. My prayer is a heartfelt prayer. Eli then answered. He realized he had made a mistake. And he said, go in shalom. I've made a mistake. And may the God of Israel grant your petition that you have asked him. And she said, let your maidservant find favor in your sight. So the woman went her way and ate, and her face was no longer sad. Because after you poured yourself out to God, when God's conditioned your soul that you know you need him more than anything, and you fall before him in utter desperation and pour your needs out to him, and when you walk away from that kind of soul-cleansing prayer, well, your spirit's at a different place. There's joy in your life, and she has joy because she knows God is listening to her. And boy, is he listening to her, because he's going to take the national adversity that the country was going through, he's going to take her personal adversity, and he's going to condition her heart to bring forth a child that's going to restore the nation to God. I don't know about you, but I still believe in that God. He can take a family like yours and bring forth a child that can turn your family around, your city around, your country around. I believe it. This is what happened. What we find from her prayer is her prayer moved God. And therefore, prayer should move us. It says in verse 19, then they rose early in the morning and they worshiped before the Lord. That's the kind of family they were. They returned again to their house in Ramah. And Elkanah had relations with Hannah, his wife, and the Lord remembered her. The word remember in Hebrew, zakar, means to remember with action. Not that God can forget anything because he's omniscient. but he remembers with action what she had said. And it came about in due time after Hannah had conceived, she gave birth to a son and she named him Samuel. Why? Because she said, I've asked him of the Lord, which I told you last week. The word Samuel means to ask of God. She asked and God answered. And she had a little boy. She followed God when God wasn't giving her what she wanted, and she followed God when he gave her what she wanted. That's a faithful saint right there. That's Hannah. It says in verse 21, the man Elkanah, he went up with all of his household to offer to the Lord a yearly sacrifice to pay his vow. But Hannah did not go up, for she said to her husband, I will not go up until the child is weaned. Then I will bring him that he may appear before the Lord and stay there forever. She's going to give her child away. Imagine. And Elkanah, her husband, said to her, now he finally, he represents men well when he says this. Do what seems best to you. If you think you need to wean the child, honey, go right ahead. Remain until you have weaned him. Only may the Lord confirm his word. So the woman remained and nursed her son until he was weaned. You have to ask yourself, how long was that? In Jewish homes at that time, it was about 3 years. Could you imagine just the sweetness of that? That she who had wanted this little baby for all these years now gets this miracle child. And that little boy, you know, comes from a baby in her arms. So then he's running around the house. And when he's about 3 years old in terrible twos, she gives him to the priest. Think about it. But I think Samuel probably didn't go through the terrible twos and threes, right? Because he's Samuel. But she weaned him and had a great relationship with that little boy. And you'll read later that she's going to go up to the tabernacle every year to see her son and bring him special clothing because she sewed. What a mom. It says in verse 26, she said, oh, my Lord, as your soul lives, my Lord, I am the woman who stood here beside you, speaking to the high priest, praying to the Lord. For this boy I prayed, and the Lord has given me my petition, which I asked of him. So I have also dedicated him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he's dedicated to the Lord, and he worshiped the Lord there. This is her telling the priest, I know you don't remember me because you have so many parishioners, but here's my little boy, and I prayed for God. Remember, I was a lady you thought was drunk. But I wasn't. I was seeking the face of God, and God blessed me with this little miracle child. And I told God, if you give me this boy, I will give him back to you for a lifetime service. So here's Samuel. Eli, would you take his little hand? And little Samuel is going to go into the priestly mode as a little boy. And he's going to educate the high priest on how to walk with God. And it comes from that little child. I don't know where you're at in your life, what your struggle is, what your tension is, but I do know that God tenderizes hearts through trial, and he gets you to embrace him and look for him to do great things in and through you as you're obedient. I would pray that you would get that wisdom from him. Back in 1932, there was a mother who lived on a farm in Indiana, and she had the radio on back in the day. And she picked up a radio station coming out of Chicago from Harry Ironside, great pastor. And Harry Ironside at the time was telling all the people in Moody Memorial Church in Chicago to come down to the front. He was going to bless all the children as the parents gave those children to God. And so she had a little baby boy in a crib in her farmhouse. And so she went and got her little baby and scooped him up out of the crib in his little cloth baby blanket. And she took him into the kitchen in front of the radio, and she knelt down on the floor in front of the radio, and she gave that little boy to God in that little farmhouse as Harry Ironside was praying for other families on the radio. Who was her little boy is the question. His name was Dr. Gene Getz, one of the greatest professors produced by Dallas Seminary. He's impacted my life through his teaching, through his writings. He's impacted people all around the world for the Lord. And Dr. Getz will be the first one to tell you, I am who I am because my mom got down on the ground and gave me to God. I don't know where you're at as a parent, but I think the message is clear. If God blessed you in such a way, that child is really not yours. It's for you to present that child to God and say, God, here is my child. Do great things in and through this child. And if God has the tension of barrenness in your life, my heart goes out to you. Neither one of my sisters could have children. I understand that through their lives. But they turned and said, if you will not bless us with children, then we will pour our lives into children. But either way, you're obedient to God Almighty, right? Because he's providential.